The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2010 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2010. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the Internet. If you would like to find out more about the work of ACCS, please visit our website at www.accsedu.org. To order additional talks from this conference, please visit the ACCS website and click on Conferences. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
Well, why don't we, now that Doug Wilson has warmed up for me, we can get started. It's really wonderful to be back here at ACCS conference. We had a great time last year in Atlanta. Most of the faculty from our school at Tall Oaks was there. We were getting our accreditation, and we really want to celebrate. There's a tremendous amount of work involved in applying for accreditation. So our theme last year is whatever happens in Atlanta stays in Atlanta. And judging from our gathering last night, I think we have to apply the same motto here in Durham. I had the privilege of just coming back from the Durham in the UK just a couple of days ago. So you'll be glad to know they named a town after this one out there. I have 2 degrees, one in music and one in theology. I was drawn to the money, and so I was very excited about participating in a symposium on the fine arts and in classical education that was held earlier this year in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, featuring Ken Myers and Gene Veith. And while there were many wonderful ideas that were exchanged during the conference, what I particularly found fascinating was the concern among many of the panelists and the participants that classical education, with its emphasis on worldview formation, tended to reduce knowledge to the propositional, to the cognitive, to the explicative, at the expense of the aesthetic. In other words, it was the concern among many of the participants that classical schools have yet to really appreciate the unique state of affairs that artistic performance brings to our life experiences and the relevance of such performances to kingdom formation within our students. So what I'd like to do is to explore with you in this workshop the extraordinary integrative significance the performing arts have for classical education, particularly with regard to the phenomenon of performance itself. Many people pass over just how unique a state of affairs obtains in this thing called performance. This exploration involves a couple of steps. First, consideration must be given to the dissonance that exists between the Christian tradition in which classical education is situated and the contemporary currents that characterize the modern age, in which we find ourselves all too often unwilling inhabitants. For it is in this very topic, that of the performing arts, that the dividing line, the antithesis between our two cities, can be profoundly interrogated and appreciated. Specifically, I'm interested in examining 2 different dichotomies that have emerged in the modern age that profoundly affect the way we relate to the world. On the one hand, there's a dichotomy between mind and body, and this one is really pushing the idea that knowledge is propositional, it's cognitive, it's theoretical. On the other hand, there's also been a dichotomy between creation and nature, which we'll explore. And what I'm really interested in there is this, how that dichotomy manifests itself in the dichotomy of meaning and nature, that there's no inherent meaning in the natural world, which is just made up of simply cause and effect processes that are devoid of any inherent meaning. I want to look at these and the development of these in light of the Enlightenment period and how it's contributed to reshaping modern conceptions of knowledge. I believe these dichotomies are at the heart of a fundamental misconception of the arts within Christian communities as well. Secondly, I want to explore then how these dichotomies have actually been increasingly challenged of late within the academy. And from there, demonstrate these challenges have much in common with the Greek paideia of the classical tradition. And from there, I'll trace out how these frames of reference distinctive to paideia were developed uniquely by the early church, where the body provided the site for the redemption of the senses in relation to a distinct Christian paideia. And then I'll conclude with a few thoughts on how a robust appreciation of the nature of performance in the Christian tradition provides us with a profound foundation from which fine arts can flourish in our classical schools and classrooms. And then we should have some time for some interaction, Q&A, comments, whatever you like at the end. In 1641, in his work Meditations, René Descartes wrote the following: "Simply by knowing that I exist and seeing at the same time that absolutely nothing else belongs to my nature or essence except that I am a thinking thing, I can infer correctly that my essence consists solely in the fact that I am a thinking thing. It is true that I may have a body that is very closely joined to me, but nevertheless, on the one hand, I have a clear and distinct idea of myself insofar as I am simply a thinking, non-extended thing. And on the other hand, I have a distinct idea of body insofar as this is simply an extended, non-thinking thing. And accordingly, it is certain that I am really distinct from my body and can exist without it." Talk about having too much time on your hands. Now, this quote is largely representative of a dichotomy between mind and body that emerged within continental rationalism of the 17th century. The Frenchman Descartes laid the foundation for the German tradition of Gottfried Leibniz and Christian Wolff, who both maintained that the senses represented a lower, imperfect cognitive power in relation to the higher power of the intellect. Immanuel Kant, while following Alexander Baumgarten in rejecting the designation of the senses to this lower form of knowledge, nevertheless famously argued for a pure reason that entails formal structures that are in no way based on anything physical and are thus independent of our embodied phenomenal selves. Kant further argued that moral laws were truly moral only to the extent that they issued from pure, practical reason, detached from feeling, emotion, or bodily constraints. Now, this relativization of the senses in the knowing process accompanied the reappropriation of our world as impersonal nature rather than divine creation. Prior to the modern age, creation embodied the divinely imparted meaning and purpose, what the Greeks called telos, that provided the blueprint for the substantiation of meaning in our cultural pursuits. With the breakup of Christendom, however, it became increasingly plausible to view knowledge as limited solely to that which could be verified by a method, namely the application of science and mathematics. It was argued that only those things that could be verified by the empirical method were those things that could be known in a way that was completely detached from the preconceptions of the observer. Anything that was not subjected to or that failed this method was reduced to the state of personal relativity and excluded from the arena of knowledge. And this exclusion included the Christendomic conception of meaning and purpose as a reality divinely embedded in a created order, since method was impervious to meaning. You can't put telos in a test tube. Now, it's particularly this latter dichotomy, the dichotomy between divine creation, which is reconceptualizes the unverifiable domain of religion. An impersonal nature, which is the domain of science, that has had devastating effects on the imagination, particularly what Edmund Burke coined as the moral imagination. Since the imagination was classically conceived as the integrative instrument by which a world infused with divine meaning can be accessed, the imagination, it was believed, was constituted by a symbolic universe where the images recorded by the senses are stored in our memory and are in turn, they're constructed into metaphors, analogies, parallels, paradigms, by which the totality of our experience can be synthesized and expressed in an intellectual, moral, and spiritual life. However, by replacing creation with a natural world constituted by cause and effect processes devoid of any inherent meaning, the senses can mentally record only data, so that the imagination is starved of any divine meaning and purpose with which to integrate. And thus, by its nature, the imagination is left to shrink and contract within itself. In many ways, this is where you see the birth of the avant-garde. And as David Wells has pointed out, it used to be the avant-garde were just a peripheral little group in society. Today, the whole culture, in many ways, is avant-garde. Now, since the 1950s, however, this dialectical conception of knowledge, as it relates to this mind-body dualism on the one hand and the nature creation, or better, nature-meaning dualism on the other, has begun to crack under an increasing awareness within the academy of the manifoldness of knowledge. First, with regard to the mind-body dualism, it's been recognized by philosophers, anthropologists, and sociologists alike that inasmuch as the mind exists in a body, we as humans cannot but experience ourselves simultaneously in and as our bodies. Statements such as, "my foot hurts" and "I'm in pain" are in fact synonymous statements that indicate I don't just have a body, I am my body. We experience things done to our bodies as done to ourselves. The recognition of the centrality of the body and human identity has provided the foundry of a rich appreciation of the role of the body in the shaping of human culture. The renowned cultural anthropologist Mary Douglas makes a distinction between the physical body and the social body, noting that cultural concerns about the body, such as taboo codes and ethical identity and conceptions of purity and impurity, are frequently metaphors for social relationships and boundaries. From this cross-cultural perspective, we should not therefore be surprised to find that St. Paul's conception of the human body as a social organism in 1 Corinthians 12 was in fact a very popular rhetorical topos in the Greco-Roman world that idealized social harmony in somatic terms. The body is the perfect image of unity and diversity. Furthermore, the relationship between the human body and society has notably been the subject of research by French sociologist Pierre Bourdieu and his theory of habitus, who argues that the body provides a canvas whereby the senses can in fact be shaped by cultural sensibilities. These socially shaped senses include not only the senses proper, you know, taste, touch, smell, and so forth, but also our sense of beauty, our sense of responsibility, our sense of right and wrong, our sense of humor, hence demonstrating a cultural link between sense and the senses. Now, it is here with Bourdieu's observation that the body provides a canvas whereby the senses can, in fact, be shaped by cultural sensibilities, that we see the collapse of the second dichotomy, the dichotomy between meaning and nature, creation and nature. Recent work in what's been called performance theory is really calling into question the dichotomy between nature and meaning. Performance theory is a scientific attempt to conceptualize performances, whether they're ritual, theater, sport, art, music, as processes by which acts and utterances are endowed with creative or generative qualities known as performatives. Now, the interesting thing about performatives is rather than corresponding to reality, performatives create or generate reality. For example, think of a wedding. The bride and groom enter into the church as fiancés are engaged to be married. And about, you know, whatever, 50 minutes later, they exit the church and they're married. So what happened? What accounts for that transformation from engagement to marriage? Well, what happened is very fascinating. A person of authority, a clergyman, declared the man and woman husband and wife. And the words do it. The words transformed an engaged couple into a married couple. You'll notice that when a clergyman pronounces a man and woman husband and wife, no one ever responds to those words with the question, is that true? I mean, this is because the declaration itself entails truth. It creates a reality. There's no reality objective or previous to the statement by which its truthfulness can be ascertained. Like if I said, you know, it's really hot outside. Well, you have a way of verifying that, right? You can go and open the window and see a previously existing state of affairs outside, whether it's hot or cold, and you can judge my statement. But when somebody says, I now baptize you in the name of the Father, the Son, and Holy Spirit, where's the open window that you can check for that? It's very interesting. Baptisms are interesting because in the Greco-Roman and Jewish worlds, water washings were a dime a dozen. They were everywhere. If you lived either Jew, Greek, Roman in the Greco-Roman world, you went through some kind of ceremonial washing at some point in your life, probably several. What made these Christian washings so unique? What makes them unique, what sets these washings apart, it's not the water per se, but the Trinitarian words that performatively informed the water into the cosmic waters of a new creation. We witness performatives every day in our court system. A judge declares the defendant not guilty. And that, in social terms, is that. As far as the court is concerned, the judge's words make irrelevant whether the defendant actually committed the crime or not. Authoritative words have the power to reshape reality. Now, what's fascinating about performances as the performative reshaping of reality is that they have the power to reintegrate, as it were, the imagination with our ecology. In the world of performance, the imagination is conjoined through the performing body with various material, substantial, concrete media that gives such an imaginative world its concrete enactment. For example, both the violin and a musical score of Bach are the tangible media for a musician. Those are the things, when I say I'm a musician, that's a very abstract thing. But when an instrument comes into my hand and when a score of music comes, then it becomes tangible. You're able to see what a musician is. But as long as the violin remains in its case, as long as the score of Bach remains on the shelf, we can talk about Bach completely separated from the musician. We can think about it, we can conceptualize Bach completely amputated from the music. But once the concert hall lights are dimmed, once the violinist steps out on the stage, once the music is open and the bow is put to the strings, suddenly something happens. Bach and the musician become one. They become inseparable. The binaries and distinctions and dichotomies that characterize mundane life break down in performances. They break down in all kinds of performances, musical, artistic, liturgical. They're in fact reconfigured in new relationships by virtue of the unique state of affairs provided by the performance itself and its ability to conjoin what are otherwise disparate phenomena. Hence, in performances, there is no longer a dichotomy between the natural world and the world of meaning. Since the natural world is transformed through movies and plays and symphony orchestras into an imaginative synthesis through the bodies of the performers. And hence, it's through performances, either as participants or audience, that the senses of our bodies can be shaped in terms of distinct cultural sensibilities. Now, this integration of imagination, body, and ecology through performance, particularly in what we call today the performing arts, is by no means a recent or novel discovery. This performative integration is, in fact, an integral part of our classical Christian inheritance, going back to the Greek paideia and its Christian appropriation, to which I now turn. Werner Jaeger notes in his great work, Paideia, The Ideals of Greek Culture, that paideia had as its purpose the formation of a particular kind of human, one in which heroic virtues, the arete, embedded particularly in the texts of Homer and Hesiod, were embodied in the hearts and the minds of his students. As evident in the formative work of Plato, such a formation was inextricably linked to the practice of what the Greeks called theoria, the imaginative contemplation of self and cosmos in relation to the transcendent. Theoria provided the means by which one could discover the laws that govern the totality of reality, and hence realize one's purpose in relation to that cosmic order. In the Timaeus, Plato proposed that the contemplation of the cosmos could lead the soul to God and hence transcend the cosmos, a concept echoed in Aristotle's De Philosophia, as well by Middle Platonist Philo and Neoplatonist Plotinus. The contemplation of the cosmos entailed an interest in the senses of the body, where particularly sight was appropriated as the foundation of philosophy and the sense that leads to a discovery of divine truth. Plato writes in his Timaeus, "The sight, in my opinion, is the source of greatest benefit for us. For had we never seen the stars and the sun in the heaven, none of the words which we have spoken about the universe would ever have been uttered. And from this source, we have derived philosophy, that which no greater good ever was or will be given by the gods to mortal man." In his pursuit of beauty in the Symposium, Plato appropriates visual beauty as that which initially inspires the philosopher to mount the heavenly ladder to God, who is absolute beauty. For Plato, both soul and body are deeply sensitive to beauty. And it was the practice of theoria that united beauty, morality, and intellection in the formation of our humanity. Thus, the soul ascends into what Plato calls in the Symposium the wide ocean of intellectual beauty. It is there that we find life, that which is eternal and perfect and incorruptible, absolute in its proportion and symmetry, in short, absolute beauty. Now, following the exhortations of St. Paul in developing a distinctly Christian paideia, Christian apologists followed this cosmic trajectory by reflecting on the nature of the cosmos as creation and God as creator. Second century hymns such as the Odes of Solomon and writers like Clement, Tertullian, celebrated creation as a means by which one could contemplate the very nature of God himself. In his work on the 6 days, the Exeimeros, which became paradigmatic for Byzantine creation theology, Basil of Caesarea argued that through the revelation of creation, one could encounter something even of the divine nature. "Let us glorify the master craftsman for all that has been done wisely and skillfully. And from the beauty of the visible things, let us form an idea of him who is more than beautiful. And from the greatness of what is perceptible and circumscribed, let us conceive of him who is infinite and immense, and who surpasses all understanding in the plenitude of his power." For the patristic tradition, this encounter with the divine nature through nature is possible because the divine logos and creation have in fact conjoined together in the incarnation. such that Ephraim could speak of the Old Testament, New Testament, and nature as three harps on which the church played the music of Christ, all proclaiming the same God in perfect harmony. However, while the incarnation has reawakened God's divine glory in creation, it was believed that such a reawakening remained obscured by the fallen sense humanity has of the world. In other words, as fallen creatures, we can't even recognize the renewal of the cosmos through the incarnation. So the union of heaven and earth in the incarnation has to extend into the sacramental life of the church, together with its project of Christian education and culture, Christian paideia, in order to awaken the senses to the renewed condition of the created order. Hence, for Ephraim, speaking from the Syrian tradition, baptism bestowed upon the believer a new physical sense that is able to receive knowledge of God through sanctified sensory experiences. Augustine, in his Confessions, Northern Africa, described his experience of baptism in Eucharist in terms of the divine reconstitution of the senses. This is from chapter 10. "You, O Lord, called and cried aloud and shattered my deafness. You were radiant and resplendent. You put to flight my blindness. You were fragrant and I drew in my breath and now pant after you. I tasted you and I feel but hunger and thirst for you. You touched me and I am set on fire to attain the peace which is yours." As such, the body, washed in baptism, became the location for Christianity, one that focused on the redemption of the senses in the performative theater of a distinctly Christian paideia that shaped aesthetic sensibilities in accordance with the new creation in Christ. So what I want to do is I want to explore three dimensions, dimensions quite literally, three ways of relating to time and space in which the early church performed Christianity: the sonic dimension, the visual dimension, and lastly, their synthesis in the dramatic or theatrical dimension. If I did it a little better, I would have put that on your outline. I'm sorry. Maybe that one will be on the other page. Given the Christians were referred to as the called ones, the kritos, who came to faith through the hearing of the word of Christ, the acoustic or sonic dimension of human experience was profoundly shaped by Christianity. The patristic emphasis on the power of words arose largely from the Greco-Roman tradition, which stressed the art of rhetoric for an educated humanity. Both Plato in his Phaedrus, not so much as Gorgias, and Aristotle recognized that the soul was deeply affected by the oral reception of rhetorical delivery. Hence, Aristotle reflects on the loudness, pitch, and rhythm of the voice for an effective hypokrisis, or delivery, one that puts the audience into an emotional frame of mind favorable to the orator's case. Aristotle's pupil, Theophrastus, is reported by Plutarch to have considered hearing the most emotional of all the senses. Moreover, by connecting voice inflections with body gesticulations, Theophrastus mirrors Cicero, who thought that every human emotion, called the motus animi, had an inherent embodiment of look, gesture, and sound. Now, it was within this sonic world of rhetoric that a distinctly Christian soundscape emerged, at the center of which was the proclamation of the gospel. This soundscape, empowered by the Holy Spirit, set the stage for what patristic scholar Carol Harrison has called transformative listening. Christian rhetoric embodied in the sermon or homily sought to awaken the imagination through sound, inspiring the listener not merely to hear, but also to understand, to apprehend scripture that was interpreted in light of the Christ event. As such, the recitation of scripture provided a map of the cosmos, recreated in Christ, which served as an aural foundation for reconstituting one's life as a mimetic imitation of the virtues embedded in sacred discourse. In the midst of a relatively illiterate populace, Christianized rhetoric had the power to reshape the sonic appetites and expectations of the general population. To kind of get our mind around this, it could help to contrast our age today. We in the modern age tend to listen for the purposes of either gathering data, you know, the business phone call, whatever, just give me the facts kind of listening, or for amusement, you know, for simple entertainment like music or just chit-chat. But we rarely listen for the distinct purpose of being transformed, to be renewed, to be recreated through sound, through the sanctification of hearing. And I think to that extent, we have considerably lost an extraordinary gift of the Christian church, which is the sacred speech of the Christian sermon and how it shapes our sonic expectations, our listening expectations. This, by the way, if you've ever wondered why how Puritans could sit through two-hour sermons, well, now you know. That's simply the flowering of transformative listening. And the reason why we can't sit through 10 minutes is because we lost it. That's a serious thing. You know, Alan Bloom, in his book, The Closing of The Closing of the American Mind, right? Likens tradition or contrasts tradition with a train. It's not like you can just jump off tradition and then jump back on again. Once you've jumped off, you've cut off the link. It's gone. So what we tend to represent, I see here in classical education, is sort of the bubbling up again, a rediscovery of something that's really been lost. Might make for a good book. It is here, in the sacred realm of the sonic, that we can appreciate the contribution of poetry. We have to bear in mind it's not until the 18th century and the advent of the English novel that literature is split, you know, into the prose and poetry camps. Stephen Brigid has observed the classical conception of poetry spanned the whole of imaginative literature, and it was classified more, obviously, in accordance with specific kinds, such as epic and lyric. It was Cicero who wrote that, quote, if the Iliad had never existed, the tomb where Achilles' body was buried would have buried his memory as well, close quote. Father James Shaw explains it is in the sense that poets were more important than generals and politicians in antiquity. Quote, the polity, with no one to sing its praises, that is, with no poets, will soon disappear among men unknown and unlamented, close quote. Caesar Augustus understood this well. A major difference between the Roman Republic and the Augustan age is that the empire relied not on scholars like Varro or philosophers like Cicero for its propaganda, as it were. The vision of the imperial glory was celebrated by poets, Horace, Virgil, Ovid. And they communicated the ideal and the glory of Rome to the spiritual imagination of the Senate and citizenry alike. Hence, Horace could celebrate, neither civil strife nor death by violence will I fear, while Caesar holds the earth. The rise of Christian poetry ascended out of the soil of the Hebrew Psalms into the budding of the Marian Magnificat and the Song of Simeon, the blossoming of the 2nd century Odes of Solomon, the 4th century Hymns of St. Ephrem the Syrian. And this was a poetry that heralded a different king, a true king, and celebrated a true cosmic kingdom of which Caesar was only a parody, a kingdom that would emit the fragrance of the epical achievements of Dante, Shakespeare, and Milton. And sweeping up the words of poetry, of course, is the all-important phenomenon of music. Plato's Pursuit of the Good in his Republic outlines his musicipedia, his music and poetry program that provided the chief means by which rhythm and harmony could be communicated through the body and sunk deeply into the recesses of the soul. Following the Pythagorean concept of the music of the spheres, where the entire cosmos is subject to the same laws of proportion that rule music, sacred music sought to awaken on earth the music of the heavens in order to transform both its music makers and its perceivers into heavenly beings. Hence, Gregory Nazianzus talks of the indispensable role of singing in Christian worship in uniting both the Christian community on earth with the angels of heaven, and thus, in our worship, exemplify the harmony of creation. Maximus the Confessor writes, "In this light, the soul, now equal in dignity with the holy angels, and having learned to praise in concert with them, is brought to the adoption of similar likeness by grace." Gregory of Nyssa conceived of creation as the temple of the Lord of creation that was sung into being, and it was this divine song that was to be echoed in the hymns of praise among God's people, but it's been silenced by sin. As a result of the work of Christ, however, people excluded by sin could now rejoin in the liturgy of heaven and earth, and in so doing enter into the Holy of Holies to worship with the angels. Now, along with this acoustic environment, this performed Christianity, the classical tradition was concerned with the sanctification of the visual as well. For Aristotle, art, or techne, was defined as the trained ability of making something under the guidance of rational thought. And it's very important to note that when Aristotle, or actually the ancient world, antiquity, talked about rational thought, they were referring to something integrally related to wonder and awe, which we'll get into in my talk tomorrow. It was the 4th century BC painter Pamphilus who introduced panel painting as a school subject, and who foreshadowed the rise of the quadriga by his insistence on a knowledge of arithmetic and geometry among all his students. Paintings range from small-scale works of art for domestic decorative purposes through to heroic portraits of civic leaders and famous battles, climaxing into cultic images. Rome used art as a visual display of power. Captured sculptures and paintings, you know, booty from their military conquests, were used to adorn triumphal processions, and sculpture and other visual images were employed as part of rituals of power in the Augustan age. Now, in early Christianity, artistic symbolism took on a heightened significance, at least in due part because of the multi-ethnic nature of the growing church, and that the multi-ethnicity encouraged the use of easily recognizable symbols that transcended language barriers. You could think of the ichthys, the fish, for example. An emerging iconography in the East sought to sanctify the visual, shaping the optical sense with earthly materials transformed into heavenly visions of new creation. You may have heard icons described as windows into heaven. Crossing over into the medieval West, the developing Augustinian theology ascribed a primacy to the sense of sight in relation to the doctrine of divine illumination. Most notably developed by Bonaventure, light became the key motif for understanding. So just as the physical sight was dependent on physical light, so spiritual sight was dependent on divine luminosity. Hence, for Bonaventure, the illumination of the Holy Spirit upon the mind enables us to imaginatively reinterpret the natural world around us as a divine theater of glory, a reinterpretation made explicit in the idealized work of the artisan. Divine illumination entails the overlapping of the natural world with a sanctifying imagination, thus transforming the world around us into images of new creation and setting the stage for Da Vinci, Michelangelo, and Raphael. And finally, both the acoustic and visual senses are drawn together in the world of drama and theater. Classicist Jeremy McKinney observes that Greek audiences were drawn to two central features in dramatic performances: the drama-like movements of the actors and the sound of the spoken word. The plays were all composed in a variety of meters, and the Greeks listened with open ears, not just to the message of the words, but to the sound and the rhythm of each line. Aristotle recognized in his Poetics that dramatic performances did not so much reflect living as essentialize it. Dramatic performances presented paradigms of life. Artistic imitation thus idealized the world, representing what's there in our ecology and in our culture and our society, but often hidden to our sight. Aristotelian artwork as such lives a kind of double life. It's mimetic, and it's imitative in the Platonic sense, but it's also unique to itself, creating a unique state of affairs set apart from the life it's imitating. This uniqueness enables art to function as a social cathartic for Aristotle, particularly as it related to tragedies. He had this very interesting insight that enacting the very worst possible human crimes, you know, incest, matricide, murder, the theater actually can purge us of these drives in a process that Aristotle identified as catharsis or cleansing. He has this interesting insight that in art you can combine two otherwise incompatible emotions, like fear and joy. That's why I think we get attracted to horror movies or roller coasters or something. I mean, we're absolutely horrified and we love it. And that's very strange. That's a performance is able to take these binary dichotomies and bring them together. Now, this representational significance of drama is precisely the justification appealed to by the early Christian writer Tatian, who's a student of Justin Martyr, in his denunciation of Greek theater. Because performances were mimetic, that is, imitative or representative of the world around us, they had the tremendous power, says Tatian, in shaping our perception of the world as it was understood, however, in pagan terms. Thus, while early Christians were generally ascetic toward the theater, they turned toward the dramatic portrayal of the new creation in Christ in the eschatological drama of the liturgy. In fact, in the Byzantine East, the liturgy required a church, a form of church interior very similar to the Greek stage. The altar is placed behind a screen pierced with three doors, with icons surrounding them, the iconostasis. And of course, the liturgy of the Mass in the West would provide the foundry for the medieval mystery and passion plays, themselves precursors of Shakespearean theater. And there's a lot of wonderful work that's being done right now looking at Shakespeare in light of the medieval mystery plays. In short, the patristics understood the creation as redeemed in the incarnation and the body as the location for encountering that redeemed creation, as both body and ecology were imaginatively integrated into distinctly Christian theoria. Through the healing of the sacraments and the project of Christian paideia, the creation proleptically restored in the union of heaven and earth in the incarnation could be both encountered and appropriated in a life of sensory devotion that anticipated in the present the glorious resurrection and new creation yet to come. As such, the body redeemed in the restored ecology of Christian performance provided what Polanyi calls the aesthetic framework through which the believer could perceive and thus contemplate the world in a way particular to that sacramental and scholarly framework. So now, just turning to our classrooms. What if we thought about our classes in light of how performance shapes our perceptions of the world? The classroom is, in a very real sense, a place of performance, as is this going on right now. The various features of performance are all there in the classroom. There's a formality. Notice you're not all talking and interrupting, right? I have my little penguin tie on. There's gestures, hand raising. I'm thinking of something that I use as a teacher, but I won't talk about. Studying, the teacher stands, the students sit. There's voice intonation. There's school uniforms. There's various media such as books, writing, instruments, papers, rulers. All of these features combine to create a unique state of performative affairs known as the classroom. Now, the arts and our classical inheritance encourage us to think of our classrooms as a sensory theater, a place where our students can embody foretastes of a new creation, a way that's unique to the dynamics of performance. And there's so many ways we can apply this, and perhaps during the Q&A we can explore some more. But all I have really time for is to do one, and I'm going to do the one that's most familiar to me, and that's the realm of sound. Soundscapes in our classroom. These are just some suggestions. First, don't underestimate the significance of the sound of prayer. Prayer has the power to create sacred space. a sanctified environment that can in turn sanctify all that goes on in the classroom. In terms of singing, dialectic and rhetoric classes have wonderful opportunities of integrating song into their curricula, particularly in the foreign languages. Latin classes can introduce Gregorian chant. Greek classes can discover the octoeros, that's the eight modes of Byzantine music. At our school, we begin the day with singing hymns. And at lunch, it's preceded by the singing of the doxology. And at this last conference in Lancaster, I found out there's a school, an Episcopal school, that begins the morning in song and prayer and ends the day in song and prayer, sort of a morning and evening rhythm. And by the way, it is also here with music that we can emphasize the concept of transformative listening for our students. I'll get into that just a bit. Math teachers can demonstrate how Pythagoras used arithmetic and harmonic means to construct the musical scale. Mathematical ratios can be demonstrated simply on a guitar string. So the student can see and hear the relations 1 to 2, 2 to 3, 3 to 4 to form like, you know, fourths, fifths, octaves. History and geography classes can experience times and cultures by hearing their music. And this provides a highly illuminative arena for discussion. For example, in my theology class, I've been recently introducing the section on Trinitarian theology by playing back-to-back recordings of Bach's Mass in B minor. This is a section from it. And the Islamic call to prayer, the Azan. And after the students listen to both recordings, I simply ask them this question: which of these two composers, as it were, do you think is a Trinitarian? Now, which one do you think they pick? And then we ask why. Why did you pick that? And we get in these fascinating discussions on how this perfect blend of unity and diversity are embodied in sound and in music. Same thing can be done if you want to demonstrate the difference between a worldview, say, the worldview of Christendom versus the worldview of the modern age. I've put on the board music one and then music two. And I tell the students, I'm going to play you a piece here, music one, piece here, music two. And I just want you to write down the attributes of the music that come to mind. And so then I'll play something like for music one, Bach, Mozart, something like that. And then for music two, I like playing George Crumb's Black Angels. I don't know if you've ever heard that. It's really brutal. And then they write down, we spend a good 15 minutes just listening. And they write down, they're actually timid. What do you want me to, whatever comes to your mind, write it down. And then we talk about it. And what do you notice the difference between the two pieces? And the attributes they come up with are fascinating. They notice that Bach's piece or Mozart, whatever it is, has symmetry, order, tension, resolution, which I had a student note was eschatological. It's like, I love you. I've heard another one talk about one has a sense of home. It has a sense of not just stability, but that I belong here. And that this preserves vital life processes. On the other side, randomness, disillusionment, angst, chaos, hopelessness, alienation. And then this leads into a discussion on the modern age. Another thing you could do, you've been throwing around the word soundscapes a lot, or acoustic environments. You can have students sit out side and listen for an extended period of time. Simply listen to the world around, the natural world around them. They'll find that it is an arena of revelation. And then ask them, how does, just pretend you're blind. How does listening to this world around you affect your relationship to the world? What does it say? What does it mean? To be in this creation. Inadvertently, unless you're sequestered in a real remote part of town, you'll just find how noisy and clanky our world is. how our machines drown out the acoustic ecology of our creation. And then you can, that's a great discussion. How does that affect your relationship to the world, then, you say? So music and sound are powerful purveyors of life experiences, and I encourage you to think of all the creative ways you can teach a subject through the use of music and sound, rather than just simply the theoretical, the cognitive, reading a chapter. Listen to music instead, and use that as the discussion points. And in so doing, you not just sanctify the heart, you sanctify the hearing. You create an aesthetic sense. They'll want an appetite. They'll develop an appetite for wanting beautiful things. What we've seen is the inextricable link between imagination, body, and ecology, brought together in the unique state of affairs that obtain in the dynamics of performance. In classical Christian paideia, the goal of this triad of creation, body, and contemplation was the formation of a true humanity, where theoria provided the imaginative means by which divine revelation embedded in creation could be received and savored through the body in various sonic, visual, and theatrical performances. In contrast, this tripartite unity fragments in our modern age, where the mind-body dichotomy simply mirrors the amputation of the cosmos from any transcendent reality. As such, theoria, the divine contemplation that brings together body and creation, withers away. It dies. It simply doesn't have the frames of reference to sustain itself in modernist conceptions. And performances then, and we're filled with them all around us, they're reduced to mere amusement and trivial entertainment. Now, I need not tell you that this confusion has unfortunately not escaped the church. In his book entitled Against the Protestant Gnostics, Philip J. Lee, himself a Protestant, argues that by the middle of the 19th century, quote, it became apparent that a form of Christianity quite different from any known on the continent or in the British Isles had not only asserted itself, but had become the typical religion of North America, close quote. This development, Lee argues, is striking parallels with ancient Gnosticism, particularly with regard to two things. A separation between God and the goodness of creation, on the one hand, and a profound mistrust of the body, on the other. Furthermore, the sustained analysis of David Wells has demonstrated how the complex world constituted by the intersection of capitalism and urbanization, technology, and telecommunications provides cultural support and hence tacit plausibility for modernist assumptions about knowledge in the human person. The experience of our world through the lens of a technological society has contributed to conceptions of psychology and body where truth has been replaced by the subjective, the moral with the therapeutic, and we can add along with this beauty with preference. Wells has noted that the gospel in the modern age has predictably followed suit, replacing sin with shame, and the classical redemption with a highly privatized therapeutic faith. With modern commodified culture providing the tacit subsidiary lens, the interpretive framework through which modern Christians are perceiving the world, the practice of theoria, including its inherent unity of imagination, body, and ecology, becomes increasingly implausible and odd. So here stand our two cities, two ways of being human. The amputation of knowledge from aesthetics produces an art and music that simply manifest this dichotomy and confusion. If our aesthetic sense, however, provides the means by which we know divinely imparted meaning in creation, generating an imaginative sense of the world as a theater of divine wonder and beauty, then our production and perception of the fine arts will be proportionately wondrous and beautiful. The recovery of classical education has an enormous opportunity, for it has the frames of reference for truly beautiful art that redeems the senses and prepares us for our resurrection. Music within classical consciousness is the means by which the beauty of a pre-fallen created order can be communicated to the imagination, embodying the cosmic order as meant to be and as redemptively become in the revelation, the infinite kenotic love of the Trinity in the incarnation of Christ. Visual art embodies a sense of beauty that draws us into an encounter with the true and the good, delighting us with a proleptic manifestation of the beatific vision where heaven and earth come together as one, when God floods the cosmos with his incorruptible glory and life-giving radiance. Poetry recreates language to radiate the divine similarities embedded in the cosmic order and hidden from our sight. The culinary arts unify ingredients into a recipe of synesthetic proportionality and symmetry that foretaste the messianic banquet yet to come. It is this vision of art that is our inheritance by right of our baptisms. It is this vision of art that beckons us and welcomes us to partake of its splendors and savor its beauties, and in doing so, prepares the cosmos for its future transfiguration when Christ returns, when God will be all in all. Thank you. We have a couple minutes just for a few questions or comments or anything to explore. I know it's like drinking from a fire hydrant. Yes. Is my talk available? See, if I say yes, I might get 500 email requests. So no. But see me afterward as I wink and nudge, right? Another thing, too, with what I did with music, could do with visual art as well. It's every bit as evident. You look at anything from Michelangelo, Raphael, medieval paintings, particularly it's a reflection on the human in relation to creation, and then put up a picture of, you know, a photograph of a skyscraper. So what's the difference between how we relate to creation in both these pictures? Yes, sir. Well, back there. Yeah, that's a good question. So the question is, to what extent is iconoclasm and the state of modern art related? And I need to answer it in 30 seconds. I don't know the answer to that question. I'd have to reflect on it. I mean, I know people have reflected on iconoclasm. It's been a minority position in the church. It just comes in waves periodically. And there's an inherent nervousness with the image given the second commandment. But the church's eschatology in both East, West, Protestantism has tended to always default back to its eschatology to deal with that, it seems to me. That new creation involves the reunification of heaven and earth in a way simply was unparalleled in the Old Testament, outside of the temple. And the temple, obviously, had lots of images in it, very interestingly. Seraphim, cherubim, that sort of. So, and I think the emphasis, too, that we can explore, perhaps, is the reduction of Christianity to a belief rather than a culture. That entails a belief. All cultures into, and the reduction of Christianity to a belief, particularly in the 19th century revivalism, really seemed to see all forms of aesthetic and ritualization as distractions. I can't recall if Finney actually writes on this, but for some reason something's jittering in the back of my file cabinet that he has something in there, but. And so I think that combined with the secularization of the arts has just made them profane to many an evangelical mind. And I think our Christianity is radically impoverished for it because we are icons. Imago Dei. We are imagers. We can't help it. So the question is, what are those images going to be? And rather than throw them all out, the question is, you know, how do you redeem them as visions of new creation? All right, we have more. Oh, okay, one more. This is from a student of mine. This is an alumni that I called security to get out of here, because I told him I don't have to answer his questions anymore. But go ahead, Gray. Security. Yeah, the question is, why does the voice change when you're in a performance-like situation? But I mean, now you should know this answer, shouldn't you? Because you weren't transformatively listening. That's it. Because in performance, things are set apart. Your clothing is set apart. Your voice is set apart. Your gesture. I don't walk around the house doing this all the time, you know. But I do that here, you see. I don't normally stand in front of people in mundane life, but I do so here, and hence the voice is going to be proportionately inflected to be concomitant with that situation. So the performances do have the power of reshaping how we encounter this world around us. And if we tap into that, like the paideia, the Greek paideia, and particularly Christendom, I think we'll find that we're going to have a very holistic approach in our education. And with that, I'll see you. Thank you very much.